Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Over the last 12 months, the total number of prisoners across Australia jumped 11% to a total of 34,000. These are the latest figures just released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Why is this happening? There's no question fighting crime requires a range of strong responses.
Police have new powers to tackle crime gangs and seize their assets, stopping drugs like ice before they reach the street. Tough new laws are putting violent offenders behind bars for longer, and suspended sentences have been abolished. So if anyone's thinking about making trouble, think again, because we're building a safer Victoria. Authorised by the Victorian Government, Melbourne.
But does locking up more and more people build a safer Victoria? South of the Murray, the prison population has grown nearly 50% in the last decade. The number of prisoners recently reached 6,200. The Victorian prison system will cost nearly $1 billion to run over the next year. The latest state budget included more than $450 million to build nearly 900 new prison beds. It's a nationwide trend.
From the outside world, it's a long walk through multiple layers of security to reach the cells at Sydney's Parklea Jail. Like jails all over Australia, this maximum security prison is coping with ballooning inmate numbers.
The number of people on remand or in jail in Queensland rose by 16% over the last year, and the state's now spending $61 million expanding its jails.
States and territories are scrambling to cope with an explosion in the number of prisoners as governments and courts take a hard line on crime.
Is prison expansion a good financial and social investment? Last week I hosted a conversation at the Wheeler Centre for Writing and Ideas in Melbourne. The event was jointly organised by the Human Rights Law Centre, Smart Justice and the Wheeler Centre. On the panel, Magistrate Pauline Spencer, who sits at the Dandenong Magistrates Court. Marlene Morrison, a former Queensland Corrective Services Commissioner. In that role, she effectively ran the state's probation, parole and prison systems. Eddie Cabillo, a Northern Territory Indigenous lawyer. He's currently the Executive Officer of NATSILS, which is the chief national body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services. And also Rob Hulls, a former Victorian Labor Attorney General. He's currently the director of the Centre for Innovative Justice at RMIT. Rob Hulls, if I can start with you, who is in prison and what do we know about the current prison population? What are the demographics of that population?
Prisons today are really the new asylums. 40%, 46% actually, of people in prisons have some form of mental illness. 44% of men and 33% of women in prison have an acquired brain injury. And indeed, over 87% of women in prison have been victims of sexual or physical abuse.
Marlene Morrison, does what Rob Hulls say resonate with you in terms of who ends up in prison?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it gives you a sense of what it is that is hard about running a prison system. People come to prison at the end of a whole range of things: failure in infant health, failure in school, mental illness, disability. What you see in a prison is literally that people with enormous disadvantage and with behaviours that concern us nonetheless.
And there ain't nobody more disadvantaged in this country than Indigenous Australians. Eddie Cabillo, what are the stats around Indigenous incarceration? They're appalling, aren't they?
They definitely are. Look, 27% is Indigenous Australians incarcerated.
27% of the prison population are Indigenous, yet they make, 2-3% of the population?
That's right, and they're 15 times more likely to be incarcerated. And women are 24 times more likely, Indigenous women, and from 2000 to 2010, women have increased 59%. And then if we look at our youth, overall in Australia, it's youth incarceration has stabilised, but for Indigenous Australians, it's 22 times more likely for Indigenous youth to be incarcerated.
And, of course, the Australian Bureau of Statistics have released those figures that the number of Indigenous women in jail has jumped 18% in just 12 months. So the figures continue to skyrocket.
Yeah, and if you then compound that with the recent cuts that the federal government's done in Aboriginal affairs, that's just going to impact further on families and children's ability to stay out of the prison situations.
Magistrate Pauline Spencer, you see people come before you week after week after week.
Tell me about some of them. Do they fit this profile?
Oh, definitely. I would say most of the people who come before us have some issue, whether it's mental health issues, acquired brain injury. I think there's a lot more people out there with acquired brain injury than are being identified in our system. Intellectual disability, learning disabilities, and then often, obviously, drug use. Past trauma is a big one. Grief and loss, loss of parents, loss of family members very early on in life, young people coming through from child protection, and now that I've been in Dandenong for so many years, I can actually see some of the young people coming through our children's court who are in the child protection system and then moving through the system, and often they're victims of trauma and family violence as children. Then those victims go into the adult system, and I've actually watched that trajectory, which is very alarming and concerning.
And do people come before you again and again and again?
There's definitely a revolving door, and you see people coming in and out.
So why are the number of prisoners going up, Rob Hulls? Are we facing an amazing crime wave which is sweeping away civil society?
No, we're not. And just from a political point of view, it's a lot easier to get a 10-second grab-up on television with words like zero tolerance, tough on crime, we're going to lock people up and we make no excuses for making our community safer. It's a lot harder to explain in that 10-second news grab that spending money on prisons is not actually new money. It's money that's been taken away from hospitals and schools. It doesn't actually make us safer. And therapeutic restorative justice, which actually addresses the underlying causes of criminal behaviour, is a much smarter investment and far cleverer because it actually achieves results. Try getting that up in a 10-second grab on the Channel 7 news, let alone convincing sometimes your cabinet colleagues that it's a smarter way to go. So whenever an election is in the wind, you'll always have someone out there saying, my law and order baseball bat is bigger than yours. And the tabloids love it, the shock jocks love it, and people, for some reason or another, get convinced that this is the way to go. Although, having said that, I think people are slowly coming to the realisation when it takes them 15 minutes to get an ambulance and their kids' class sizes are overcrowded and they can't get a hospital bed. Hang on, how come? And they have a look at budgets and they see that state budgets are spending more money on prison beds than hospital beds. They come to this realisation that perhaps something isn't working the way it should.
Marlene Morrison, I know you really want to take the politics out of the debate, but how on earth do you go about doing that? Because it's pretty central to the way we do things in this country.
Well, part of it is having people better informed. I mean, I noticed that the Australian Institute of Criminology released a report which shows the rehabilitative capability of probation and parole. Things which tell us what sorts of people thrive and are less likely to commit a crime under what sort of sentencing conditions, there's heaps of evidence on it. And I think that reaching a point where you drench the community in that information so that what the corners we push our politicians into are informed.
Let's not be Pollyanna about this. There are some people who need to go to prison.
Absolutely.
What are prisons good for and what are prisons not good for?
Well, that depends on the prison and, you know, there's a lot of complexity in that, but what prison can do and what we need it to do is to contain. So quite often there is a level of risk to the community. So it's dangerousness, it's violence, it's that deep corruption and it's entitled types of behaviour. So I think it's those which we usually need an immediate and a solution to the violence, and we also need the strength of the message to the community in terms of no, violence is unacceptable within our community. And all of this is premised, as you know, on an understanding that people will get out, that the nature of sentencing is that it's finite. So you need to construct what you do based on that knowledge right from the beginning.
The Victorian Ombudsman recently described prisons as quite overcrowded, underfunded and more dangerous than they have been for a decade. There are reports of prisoners being held in demountable shipping containers and some prisoners sharing cells. The Ombudsman's report also spoke that 38% of cells continue to have hanging points. Prisons, places where you can actually address the problems of the very complex needs of the people you've been talking about, Marlene?
Well, yes, they can, but the question is whether they are the best place in which you should do it. It's particularly true for people who are disadvantaged. If you're already disadvantaged, you have a series of fines, you end up in prison, your life is already chaotic. We put you in prison, you lose your house. If you've got a job, you lose your job. All of the wherewithal of your life is disrupted. Then we put someone out back into that chaos and potentially with it significantly worsened because of the interruptions and the disruption of having been imprisoned. Particularly with low tariff offences, that doesn't make a lot of sense and it doesn't sit with the evidence of good practice.
Eddie, you're nodding there. Let's start talking about some of the particular groups which are particularly overrepresented, like women. Let's talk first about Indigenous Australians. How can we do things differently?
We've had a Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody and 333 recommendations were made there, which would cover a majority of things raised in regards to hanging points and stuff like that. But 20-odd years on, we still haven't implemented any of those recommendations. So I'm not sure how to answer that realistically, but the reality is I think people are starting to understand that sending people to prison, majority of them shouldn't be there in the first instance. You know, I mean, minor charges such as alcohol and sleeping in public and stuff like that shouldn't even be looked at. Also, we have issues around legislation being changed around key components of taking the responsibility out of the magistrates' hands and stuff like that, like presumption of bail, mandatory sentencing, and the list goes on. And we need some leadership in these states and territories, because if you lock up an individual for a year, it's approximately $100,000 per individual and $200,000 for youth.
I'm wondering, Pauline, Indigenous people have always been overrepresented in our prisons. Why are women coming into the courts and going into prisons in increased numbers? Do you have any thoughts?
I would say most of the women that I've sentenced and have been imprisoned are women who, when you hear about it further, you hear about sexual abuse.
Is that a new phenomenon, though, in terms of the level of abuse in society, or is it somehow people responding to it differently?
I wonder whether it's about how it's being dealt with in terms of what supports are out there and whether those supports are there when people need them. Mix that with drug use, and there's links between being a victim of family violence, being suffering trauma, and then drug use, poor mental health, homelessness. So all these things are linked.
Come on. Who's first?
I have served roughly, as an adult, 5 or 6 sentences, all property offences, drug-related.
This mother of 7 is the face of an alarming trend. Women, and in particular Indigenous women, are the fastest rising group of prisoners across Australia.
This is a typical cell in our new 20-bed high-security unit here at the Adelaide Women's Prison. There's no secret of the fact that we've been operating at or above capacity for some time now, so we do need to make sure that we have the options on the table.
Conventional criminal courts, how well equipped are they to deal with these sorts of people and their complex problems? In Victoria, well, and also elsewhere around the country now, we've had a number of different ways of, or alternative ways of processing people through the courts. Rob Hulls, you introduced a number of those courts here in Victoria, didn't you?
Yeah, I had this philosophy that where we can, we should try and use the justice system as a positive intervention in people's lives. Like, we just can't arrest and imprison our way to a safer community. It doesn't work. People will come in contact with the justice system for a whole range of reasons. Old justice basically said someone breaks into your house, you send them to jail for that break and enter. Therapeutic restorative justice should be about asking why they broke into your house, because they've got a drug problem, and the drug problem is because there's been long-term mental health issues, long-term unemployment issues, family violence issues, homelessness issues. Unless you address all those issues in a holistic way, we just create this revolving prison door where people go in and out of prison. These neighbourhood justice centre, family violence courts, Koori courts, are all about looking at people's issues in a holistic way and trying to address them. And they're working. They've been independently evaluated and they're working. And they should be mainstreamed right across the justice system because they work.
Pauline, coming back to you, you work in the mainstream magistrates court in Dandenong. I know there is a drug court next door, which I've spent a bit of time in. Do you try and apply some of these techniques which are in the drug court, in the Koori court, in the family violence court, in your mainstream court?
Sure. I mean, it's really interesting at Dandenong, because, and people are welcome to come and have a look if you ever want to come to court, because we have the drug court and then we have a busy mainstream court. So the drug court has about 50 participants every year, and these are your hard end drug offenders who are committing quite serious crimes, and instead of serving their term of imprisonment, they're placed on a 2-year drug treatment order. They are seen by the court every week at the start, and then it eases up to every 2 weeks, etc. They have a care team around them, that's all their drug treatment professionals, their mental health professionals. They have housing, they have other sorts of programs to help them along the way. They're tested 3 times a week, so it's very rigorous. So there's a series of rewards and sanctions, and they do spend time in prison. If their sanctions get to a certain point, they then have to serve, say, 14 days in prison, and then they come back out and start on the order again. So the components of that are really interesting, because it's about the judicial supervision, and we know that having... They talk about the judge as coach, so, you know, we're all footy fans. If you think about changing your behaviour, just think yourself, have you ever tried to quit smoking, or, you know, you're eating too much chocolate or whatever it is, you want to exercise more. Think about, you know, if someone's just told you to do it, you're unlikely to change. So it's very effective. So what is interesting is taking that from the specialist court. You really need the specialist courts for those high-end offenders. They're complex needs. They need intervention. So, but there are other people within our system who aren't quite at that point yet, but do need a little bit more than just the one-off sentencing. They actually probably need a little bit of supervision, and that's what's really interesting in the mainstream court, is taking some of those approaches.
Damien Carrick with you. You're listening to The Law Report on RN, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. Today we're asking, do prisons always work? And is there a smarter way to tackle crime? As Magistrate Pauline Spencer says, there are now a range of specialist courts which deal with specific kinds of offenders, including Dandenong's Drug Court. Pauline Spencer has closely observed the way it works, and she now uses a lot of its approaches in her mainstream court.
Family violence is very interesting in this respect, because we need to be very strong with family violence. It's unacceptable. People need to be held accountable. So I had a guy, we'll call him John. His marriage had broken up. There'd been family violence leading up to the separation. He lost the plot. Poor mental health, major depression, drinking a lot, very abusive during contact with the children, to the point where his ex-partner had to stop contact. He was way out of control. He then started going to a house, ended up in breach of intervention order on many occasions, ended up in custody. Then it's like, well, what do you do? This person really had no offending prior to this. So as Marlene said, he's got to come out of jail eventually. So what are we going to do? So what I did is we bailed him onto what's called our credit bail program, which is a supervised bail program, which has access to a whole lot of services. Over a period of 6 months, we worked on the mental health, linking him up with those services, the alcohol, and he's doing programs along the way. We're monitoring each time he comes back to court, every 2 weeks at the start, every month after that. The police are checking in with her, making sure she's safe. She's linked in with women's services. Over time, he's doing a lot better, and at one point, about 6 months in, there was a bit of a blip. He breached the order again. He rang her and was abusive. She reported it. He was arrested and charged and remanded and brought before me. It's like, okay, right, so this is now a breach. So then it was in for a month. You're going to come out, we're going to start again, but you need to know action consequence. So you can see how you can actually use these techniques, and they're actually, you know, these are techniques that we know work in behavioural change from social sciences. But what it needs the services there, and that's often where we come undone. And when someone needs drug rehab, it's not available because those services aren't necessarily funded. People don't have housing, so if they don't have housing, there's not a lot we can do. If they're living in a rooming house, that's quite dangerous in itself. That's where it kind of comes undone, which is where I think justice reinvestment's really interesting, because that's about diverting those resources from prisons to actually what we know works in the community, and that's the missing link, I think.
Marlene, what can be achieved in prison? Is it better to park our money there, or do you reckon it's better to park our money way back, early childcare, things like that?
To do both, because you're not going to get the outcomes if you don't do both. Prisons need to be safe, secure, purposeful, and they need to be decent. If you don't do that, then you create harm, you harden people in terms of their behaviour, and you prejudice the probability that when they get out, they will not commit as many crimes or not commit a crime. So maybe if you can develop public policy that says, well, for a period of time, and it might be for 10 years, it might be for 15 years, we're going to have to not only resource more into the rehabilitative potential of prisons and probation and parole, But at the same time, we've got to do a whole bunch of work, which is in terms of the next generation of potential people who are disadvantaged or indeed who are shaping towards really dangerous behaviour. I think we've got to do both.
Damien, there is money that can be diverted now, because if you look at drug court, for example, that 50 people in drug court, that costs $1.5 million a year. To house that same cohort in prison costs $5 million. So there's your saving straight away.
Eddie, a very practical concern for you is the federal government recently announced significant cuts to the Aboriginal Legal Services, or changes to the way that Aboriginal Legal Services are funded. And some people describe this as essentially as defunding large sections of it, including the Aboriginal Family Violence Services. Now, some people say it's just a reorganisation of resources. What is your view of what is happening? What impact would that have on the incarceration of Indigenous people and Indigenous women in particular?
Just on the cuts to the Aboriginal Legal Services was an election promise, originally of $42 million, almost 50%. Then someone had a understanding that that would wipe over half of our funding and then share it across the sector, which means everyone in that sector will take a significant cut. So it's not just the Aboriginal Legal Services in that. Then the shift is that we're now $13.4 million to be cut from our budget. Basically, what that means for us is that we're currently at the stage of projecting what that cut means for each Aboriginal Legal Service across the country, and a few have already come out and basically said that they'll reduce services, close offices. Basically, the legal aid commissions will have to pick up what the Aboriginal Legal Services no longer do, which will impact, you know, on their services, also on the courts themselves, which would slow down, I'd assume, the ability of magistrates seeing people waiting to be heard, and which would mean more people on remand, which would mean people possibly staying longer on remand than the sentences that they'd probably get for the minority of offences that they'd commit, which would then mean that those people waiting, whether it be on domestic violence orders or whatever, would mean that they wouldn't be able to do any sort of rehab whilst waiting. And my learned friends here would tell you that basically that would mean that they'd be released without even going into the major area of the prison to get some rehab that would assist some of the issues that they are facing. And then if we look to the family violence, basically that's their contract ends in June, and basically will mean that they will now have to apply under the $500 million that was cut from the Aboriginal areas. Will then be up for everyone to grab that money.
We're talking here about the justice system, but we're talking also dollars and cents. And I guess what you're saying is, whether you care or you don't care about the justice outcomes for individuals, maybe in terms of dollars and cents, maybe in terms of economics, this ain't a particularly wise move. Marlene?
Well, I was just going to say, the starkest difference in terms of cost is between prisons and community corrections. There's an awful lot that if that there were just a smidgen more services, you can see that community corrections can provide the level of supervision that would satisfy the community, indeed the victims of the crime and magistrates, that it's a good decision to make to keep someone in the community, to have a level of supervision and to have them still living and working a productive life. So the difference between $17 a day, which is what you cost in terms of community corrections, what it costs for a prison bed, is so vast. I think the community is getting to better understand what community supervision is all about. It's not unlike what's being described in terms of the therapeutic courts. It's some firm supervision, some tools that allow you to respond, indeed, sometimes to put people back into prison to contain them for a while because they're really going off the rails, but to manage and assist and wrap things around an individual to make it likely that they don't commit a crime. As I say, I'm really pleased that there's now some decent Australian research evidence that shows that community corrections has a recidivism impact.
And you're talking community corrections, you're talking about before you send people to jail?
Both in terms of community corrections orders and in terms of parole. It's been a difficult conversation in Victoria, but it is a very effective form of supervision, form of transition from a very structured environment, which is called prison, into the community and provides safeguards based on that.
But the state's corrections minister, Edward O'Donoghue, is defending the government's focus on law and order.
The government makes no apologies for fixing the parole system. We inherited a parole system that was in crisis. We are all too familiar with the terrible crimes and murders that were committed by too many parolees. And yes, the consequences of the reform process we have undertaken in the parole system has led to more people being in prison.
Of course, for listeners outside Victoria, parole was changed dramatically here a year or two ago following a number of deaths by people on parole. Something like 96% of, I'm not sure of the exact figure, but the granting of parole has really reduced dramatically in this state.
And we need to know what impact that's had. So I've had a woman come and see me recently whose son was on parole. He's been in and out of jail for a drug related crimes. He has an ABI, an acquired brain injury, and he's finally been released after a number of years in and out of prison on parole. He failed to turn up to a medical appointment, right? And that was in part due to his acquired brain injury. He was arrested and put back in jail for another 12 months. And they're the sort of people that are being incarcerated because they're breaching parole. Now, you know, there are others who are breaching parole in far more sinister ways, absolutely, and need to be dealt with appropriately. But the one-size-fits-all approach is having those consequences, and ultimately it means that people will simply serve their sentence and come into the community without any supervision at all, and that will have dire consequences for our community.
Now we come back to that where we kind of started. How do you actually sell that to an electorate?
I think, Damien, we actually have to reframe the debate. We have an adversarial system of justice, and my personal view is in many areas it's past its use-by date, and the debate becomes adversarial as well. If you're in favour of therapeutic restorative justice and addressing the underlying causes of crime, you're anti-victim. If you're pro-victim, in many cases, you've got to be in favour of mandatory sentencing and longer sentencing and taking away judicial discretion, all that sort of stuff. So the debate itself has become adversarial in nature. And we've got to move away from that, because what we all want as a community is really no more victims. And, you know, we all have enormous sympathy when we see on our TV screens the Royal Commission in relation to child abuse by institutions, for instance, the fact that they are victims of the most horrific crime. But when we find out that those victims, because of what's happened to them, turn to drugs and alcohol, suffer mental illness, depression and the like, and as a result commit offences and end up in jail, we look at them as though they're dirty, rotten criminals. As I said at the outset, our jails are full of people who have been victims themselves. We just have to reframe the debate and move away from this either pro-victim and therefore you've got to go down the tough sentencing path, or pro-offender and therefore anti-victim, and you talk about this therapeutic justice stuff. We should be singing from the same hymn book, reframing the debate.
That's, I think, where we'll leave this conversation. This event was organised by the Human Rights Law Centre and also Smart Justice. Would you please help me thank our guests, former Victorian Attorney General Rob Hulls, Magistrate Pauline Spencer, former Queensland Corrective Services Commissioner Marlene Morrison, and Executive Director of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service, Eddie Kabila.
Thanks also to the Wheeler Centre and to ABC News and Current Affairs, whose coverage we featured. At our website at abc.net.au/rn, you can find podcasts, transcripts, and we also have links to the latest ABS figures on incarceration and a new report from the Australian Institute of Criminology looking at the effectiveness of parole. That's the program for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and also to audio engineer Carey Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.